Back in the mid-50s, when he was still a teenager, Delbert McClinton began performing in nightclubs and honky-tonks in Fort Worth, Texas. This set him off on what's now a five-decade career in music. It's been rocky. He's recorded albums, only to watch record labels fold under him. He was nailed by the IRS and battled drug and alcohol abuse. And he struggled to find a national audience, in part because his music crosses lines and blends influences. He can sound equally at home singing with a country fiddle, a hard-driving blues guitar, or the horns of a soul band. But he's earned the respect of his fellow musicians and performs as many as 200 dates a year to a loyal fan base. Here's his song, One of the Fortunate Few, the opening cut from his new CD, Cost of Living.
Well, for one thing, there was a whole lot of guys who'd have liked to have been in my shoes. But to upkeep on a woman like that would give an old poor boy the blues. Still, the pleasure was worth the pain of everything she put me through. And I consider myself one of the fortunate few. Yeah, and another thing, she wasn't just good looking, her imagination just wouldn't quit. She'd make you do things you never thought about, and things you wouldn't want to admit. There must be somebody else out there that feels about her like I do. And I consider myself one of the fortunate few. It felt so good to hurt so bad, the best and the worst that I ever had. I know I bit off a little more than I could chew. Still, I consider myself one of the fortunate few.
I spoke with Delbert McClinton earlier this summer. He recently recorded two songs for I Heard It on the X, an album by Los Super 7. The album was inspired by the eclectic music played by radio stations which operated for decades on the Texas-Mexican border. As a kid, did you listen to border radio?
Oh, yeah. That was like, the mystique of it was added a great deal to by the fact that the first time I found it was on a crystal set.
Oh, boy.
You know what a crystal set is?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure all of our listeners do. You could buy them with
a
kit.
Well, a crystal set is, it's something you buy a kit at the hobby shop, and it doesn't look anything at all like radio. It's got this thing a little smaller than a dime that you kind of pick around on with another little piece, and it picks up different stations. And to me, it was God's own radio, you know. But that's the first time I traded. I remember I was so enamored with that crystal set. You know, I think they cost about $3. Mm-hmm. But I traded I had an uncle who was in World War II, and when he came back, he brought a whole bunch of stuff with him. And I had this German dagger, Nazi dagger, that when in the sheath, you know. And I traded that to a guy for that crystal set. But I had to have it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where I first heard border radio. And then as I got a little older, you know, and had a car, well, you could pick it up late at night. And it came in stations I could get out of Chicago or Memphis or Nashville, which were also really good stations. But border radio was, you could buy autographed pictures of Jesus on there. You know, I mean, they sold
everything
and everything.
Wow.
If you wanted to buy it, send me the money and we'll send it to you.
You were born in Lubbock, Texas, moved mm-hmm. to Fort Worth at age 11, if I've read this right.
That's right.
Started playing and singing early on in life. What kind of music did you listen to as a kid, as a teenager?
Well, of course, in West Texas in the 40s, you heard a lot of Bob Wills, a lot of Hank Williams, and a lot of Lefty Frizzell and Nat King Cole and Sarah Vaughan. And I had an aunt, my mother's youngest sister, who had all these old, what they used to call race records, you know.
And you knew early on you had a gift for singing.
Well, I don't know that I knew it. I knew that I couldn't stop doing it, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't think I ever made a conscious decision to become a performer. I just always kind of was.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. You had an Uncle Earl in Sweetwater. Did I get that right? Who used to?
That's right.
Used to ask you to perform for the family.
Well, he drove a milk truck, and I went to his oldest son was my cousin, and we were close, and I went to spend a couple of weeks with him in Sweetwater, Texas. And Uncle Earl was just had always been he'd drink and he'd get mean. When he's mean when he drank, and he always drank. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But he heard me singing. I forget what it was now. I've lied so many times about the name of it. I think it was "Hey Good Looking," but I'm not sure.
Right.
Anyway, it was one of those old songs, either Hank Williams or Lefty Frizzell's song, I believe. And he came running out into the backyard, and he said, "Boy, do that again." And so from then on, he was a good guy because he'd get me to sing down there in the mornings at the coffee shop with all the milkmen together before they'd start their routes about 3:34 in the morning. And he just, he thought it was great. That's the first time that I thought, well, hey, you know, I think I might be on to something.
Wow, what a crowd to play to.
Yeah, really.
So as a teenager, you actually you started performing in clubs in Fort Worth,
right.
Texas. Had a band, the Straitjackets, right?
Right, yeah.
And as I read it, you got hot and would play backup for some pretty impressive musicians that would come moving through town. Tell us
about
some of those.
Well, back in that time, this was late 50s, early 60s, you know, everybody in the world wasn't in a band, so there weren't that many bands around. And I think that during that time, I was a part of the best band around, and there weren't but about three or four in Fort Worth, you know, guys out trying to play something other than country music, you know. But in the early 60s, we... got the opportunity to back up a lot of my heroes, you know, regularly. Big Joe Turner, Freddie King, Lightning Hopkins, Howlin' Wolf, Sonny Boy Williamson, T-Bone Walker. T-Bone Walker was just the best.
So you sort of went to the Juilliard School of the Blues there in Fort Worth, didn't you?
I did. I think I got into the blues that early because Dallas had a really good station called KNOK Radio. And you could hear everything on there that you couldn't hear anywhere else. So me and the guys that I was working with, we were already into blues music anyway, and I guess it was probably because of that radio station, but because of that and us learning those songs, we would back all these guys up when they'd come to town.
You played in some pretty tough places around Fort Worth, I gather, and a lot of the songs you've written over the years about honky-tonking have some really evocative images of being hit with a Harley chain or cutting somebody with a bone-handled knife. Was this just something you observed as a musician, or were you also a guy who mixed it up? I mean, did you...
No. I was never anybody that mixed it up, but I knew them all. Playing in those places I played, they're not necessarily the Spartans of the community, but they pride themselves. I remember one guy that told me, I'm a thief. He said, and I'm a damn good one. And I remember thinking, Jesus, man, where do you find where do you find any glory in that, you know? But he did.
Right. So you didn't get into scrapes, didn't get guns?
No. Good Lord, no. I've got in... I've been on the wrong side of a pistol a couple of times, but it was generally something about a woman.
Oh.
Or a woman doing it. Well, but that's a whole other bag of worms. But, yeah, you know, I've seen people shot, cut up, beat up. And it's, you know, it's nothing I want to witness anymore, but I did because I was in the right place for that.
Do you think that informed the music that you wrote in some way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's where most of it comes from. you know, I used to do a lot of, I used to have a lot of bad habits, and bad habits that would keep you up for 2-3 days in a row sometime. Mm. And on the back side of those things, there's been an awful lot of sad songs written. But, you know, it's not something that that you want to make a way of life, but it certainly was a lesson.
Right.
And so all of that stuff that I saw and participated in, which was, I never did anything I can't live with. But it couldn't help but influence. But you know, I've always liked to look at that with a little bit of hope in it. You know, regardless of how bad the situation is in the writing of songs.
Right.
I always like to put, you know, yeah, well, but I'll make it or I'll get over that. You know, because
right.
That's the only way out, man. You know.
a lot of Americans who know your name probably aren't aware that you hit the national playlist in 1962 when you played the memorable harmonica for Bruce Chanel's hit, Hey Baby. Maybe we can listen to a little bit of this.
Sure.
Let's hear it. This is Bruce Chanel's hit, Hey Baby. That was Bruce Chanel's 1962 hit, Hey Baby, with my guest Delbert McClinton playing harmonica. You know, Delbert, at times it almost sounds like Bruce Chanel is singing backup vocal to your harmonica in this. It is such a memorable Malheur piece. To tell us about this, that recording.
Well, there was a guy in Fort Worth back in that time named Major Bill Smith. And he kind of, he was, like I said, he had retired, and he was a wholesale meat salesman at the time. And there was one place in Fort Worth to record, and it was in the basement of a radio station called Clifford Herring Sound Studio. I'd hang out there every chance I got, and I remember this is how Major Bill made music. We were sitting in there one day, me and Bob talking, and the Major swung the door open. He was a real red-faced guy. And he said, "Bob, put me down for 10 o'clock Saturday morning." And Bob says, "Okay, Major, who are you bringing in?" He says, "I don't know. I'll find somebody." He had Bruce come in. It was the first night Bruce and I met, and I got some guys together, and we went in, and they recorded 5 songs. Hey Baby was one of them, and it became a worldwide classic rock and roll song.
The 80s were a rough stretch for you. You know, it's you're certainly not the only entertainer to have fallen prey to the bottle or substance abuse of one kind or another, but on the other hand, everybody's story is personal. Right. Looking back on it, does it... any particular explanation come for you getting into trouble with drugs?
Well, once again, I was in the atmosphere for it, and hell, I thought everybody did it. You know, that was the atmosphere I was in, and I liked it. And it was a trap that I walked into, just like so many other people, but. But because of the music, there came a point in my life where I said, if I don't stop doing what I'm doing, I'm not going to get to make music. And it was a pretty hard lesson. I had a friend, he's dead now, he nodded out after going to San Antonio, picking up some smack, and was headed back to Fort Worth and nodded out and did a head-on with a semi. But he was the guy that started bringing junk around. Of course, he didn't call it junk. He called it, "Hey, you want a little backup? It, you know, back up that coke with this. It'll, mellow you out. And I was one of the many guys around Fort Worth that started snorting junk. But I realized pretty quick that, you know, anything that's that good is going to have a backside to it that's equally as bad. And I started seeing that happen with some of my other friends, and so I just completely stopped.
You developed a good friendship with the New York radio personality Don Imus in this stretch, right?
Right, yeah.
Now was he a fellow partier, or was he a guy who helped you find your way out of it?
Well, it was kind of unique the way Don and I met, because he came out to a show at the Lone Star Cafe, which was a famous place back in the 70s there in New York. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. I can't imagine anybody's not. But anyway, it was the little piece of Texas in New York City. And my girlfriend at the time, who's my wife now, Wendy, said, Don Imus is here and wants to talk to you. I said, well, who's Don Imus? And she said, well, he's a disc jockey here in town, you know, a radio talk guy. And I remember around them, he and I both got to talking about our bad habits and how we needed to stop doing it and laughing at ourselves. And then the next time I'd come to town and he'd come out and he'd say, well, how are you doing? And I said, well, I'm doing pretty good in this area and that now. And I think we both got completely cleaned up, except both of us are totally addicted to Nicorette gum. I got to start smoking to get off this gum.
You still chew Nicorette gum?
Yeah, just like him, man. It's awful. It goes on all the time.
You mentioned Wendy Goldstein. You met her, and she is now your wife.
Yes.
What role did she play in getting your life together?
Well, she's my hero. She saved me. She did it all. I met her at the first Saturday Night Live we did. She's a producer for NBC News. And we kind of had a thing going on there for several years, you know. And finally, my second marriage went completely in the toilet because of me. At that point, she and I got together and eventually got married, and we've got a 12-year-old daughter together. But she came along, and she came along just as the IRS informed me that this tax shelter that an accountant that was managing what little money I had in Austin got me in a tax shelter that got disallowed, and they said, you owe us $280,000. At this time, I was making $750 a night. That included paying four guys, gasoline, and hotels. So you can imagine how we were living. Four or five guys in a room, you know. You couldn't go to the bathroom without walking across other rollaway beds. But it was a grand time, man. You know, it was sometimes the best times in your life, I think, when you're starving to death. Hmm. You know.
Were you clean then?
That's right after I started cleaning up. Wendy'd come into my life and she turned all that around. So yeah, that's I was clean at that time. I'd been clean for about a year. She came in and turned it all around and got the IRS off my back for the last $80,000. But before that, the $200,000, I had to sell my house in Texas. I had to sell everything. I nothing was in my name. But she's the smartest person I've ever met. And a guy like me needs somebody like that.
But marrying a smart woman is one of the smartest things you can do.
Absolutely. Well, not only just a smart woman, but I'm crazy about her. She's my best friend. She's my hero.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Singer-songwriter Delbert McClinton. His new CD is Cost of Living.